Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media, the proposed Mach 2 regional hydrogen hub is working to build support for the project.
They deny very categorically that Mach 2 will be using any kind of fossil fuels.
Contributor John Hurdle outlines the pros and cons being raised about Mach 2. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also examine the trend of taking a gap year before college and a University of Delaware professor's innovative effort to detect developmental delays earlier. Plus, History Matters takes us to a photo exhibit focused on the Harriet Tubman Underground Railroad Byway. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware gets tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Last fall, the Biden administration announced substantial federal grants to create a series of hydrogen hubs, with the goal of having these hubs deliver nearly a third of the 2030 U.S. production target for this fuel. One hub funded is the Mid-Atlantic Clean Hydrogen Hub, or Mach 2. It is receiving up to $750 million to bring together various government and business interests in Delaware, Southeast Pennsylvania, and South Jersey to create a hub with the promise of creating jobs while combating climate change. The U.S. Department of Energy and Mach 2 officials are holding listening sessions to discuss their plans for this hub and get public feedback, including a virtual session earlier this month. Contributor John Hurdle checked out that session, and in his latest piece at DelawarePublic.org, he takes a closer look at the arguments for and against the hub that are developing. So let's start with a quick recap. What is Mach 2 trying to do, and who's involved in trying to make it happen?
Well, Mach 2 is part of a national network of seven regional centers to produce, store, transport, and consume hydrogen. And the idea is that it would be a clean fuel for users such as long haul trucking or transit buses, other industrial uses that are seen as being hard to decarbonize. That's the big picture on these hubs. Locally, the Mach 2 hub consists of 19 partners in Delaware, South Jersey, and Southeast Pennsylvania. Those partners include corporations, government agencies, academic departments such as University of Delaware, First State Hydrogen, PBF Energy, and the plan is that they're going to begin construction next year, and then be fully operational by the end of the decade. And the federal government is providing up to $750 million in seed money for this, which will be greatly exceeded by private investment. That's the big picture.
So it is a massive project. And as it starts to move along, John, there is plenty of discussion about pros and cons associated with it. I want to start by focusing on one that seems to have been at the forefront, and that is what kind of hydrogen this project intends to produce. And they're separated into three categories: green, pink, and blue. Can you explain what they are and why this distinction is important?
Well, the fundamental fact here, Tom, is that in order to obtain the hydrogen, the operators have to split water into hydrogen and oxygen and through a process called electrolysis. And in order to do that, they need power to use the electrolyzers. And the difference in these different so-called colors of hydrogen are based on where that power comes from. So in the case of green hydrogen, that's power from renewables such as wind and solar. Pink hydrogen is that comes from nuclear power. And then so-called blue hydrogen is power from, in general, fossil fuels, but specifically from natural gas. And that is, in the view of its critics, highly problematic because it perpetuates the production and use of natural gas, which is a potent greenhouse gas emission, and the critics are saying, well, we're trying to find ways of driving down greenhouse gas emissions here, and yet we're continuing to burn natural gas. What's wrong with this picture?
So the goal would be to lean more into green and pink production. What kind of hydrogen is Mach 2 committed to produce?
Well, Mark II is committed to producing exactly those two kinds of hydrogen, green and pink. About three quarters of the hydrogen produced by Mark II would come from green sources, and most of the rest would come from nuclear, and specifically from the Salem plant in South Jersey. And a couple of percent will be coming from gases produced by a wastewater plant in Philadelphia.
But the type of hydrogen produced isn't the only environmental issue that's being raised with this project. What other possible environmental pitfalls do some of the critics see?
What I've been hearing from some environmentalists is that hydrogen actually prolongs the heat-trapping properties of methane, which is a highly potent greenhouse gas over the course of about 20 years. And in fact, according to those arguments, the use of hydrogen may even worsen global warming. And one of the problems with hydrogen, they say, is that it's a very small molecule. Therefore, it is very prone to leakage. So that's a possible problem right there. Another objection we were hearing last week, there was a listening session on the Mark II project that was held by the U.S. Department of Energy, and one of the speakers at that event, a lady from Georgetown, was worried about the possibility of water contamination as a result of water being used for this electrolysis process that we discussed before. And she was worried that given that many homes in the Georgetown area depend on private wells which are sunk into aquifers, she was worried that the water, after being used in electrolysis, might be pumped back into the ground in some contaminated form. So there was that concern as well.
What do Mark II officials say in response to some of these environmental issues that are being raised?
They deny very categorically that Mark II will be using any kind of fossil fuels for their power. And in fact, one of the first speakers during the listening session last week, he said that in his view, there was a lot of public misunderstanding out there, which apparently has been put about by some environmental groups, that the Mark II hub would, at least to begin with, produce some of its hydrogen using fossil fuels. Well, he says that's absolutely untrue, and I've also heard that from Colin O'Mara, who is the chairman of Mark II, former Denrec secretary, of course, and now a candidate for governor, and he said that using no fossil fuels was one of his conditions for taking on the chairmanship of this hub.
One site in Delaware is expected to play a key role is the Delaware City Refinery. And perhaps that's where some people start to think about fossil fuels and this project being connected. But what would the Delaware City Refinery be doing as part of this project? And what are some of the perceived benefits of it being involved?
Well, PBF, the owner of the Delaware City Refinery, plans to build an electrolyzer on that site. And one of the other speakers at the listening session was the leader of the USW local at the refinery. And he's all in favor of the idea. He said that there's been a big decline in the local refinery capacity over the last decade or so. And this has had a bad effect on jobs. So he said that setting up the electrolyzer at the refinery would help to generate jobs. It would increase local energy security, be a good economic factor.
On a larger scale, how else is Delaware expected to benefit from Mark II economically?
Well, Mark II overall is expected to generate 20,000 jobs, around about 6,000 of which would be permanent jobs. And so that'll be region wide. So Delaware would gain some portion of that.
But there are those who do question the business or economic benefits of this project. What are they saying about the potential of these hubs and perhaps where maybe they're not as promising as some of the supporters would suggest they are?
Well, yes, I spoke with an energy analyst at the University of Pennsylvania's Kleinman Center for Energy Policy. And his argument is that there's all this government money and a lot of apparent boosterism around around hydrogen. But his view is that the government has not properly thought through how all of this hydrogen is going to be used. He said that the question is a lot more complicated than simply building the hydrogen hubs, that there needs to be a lot more thought in how this will be used. And the other potential pitfall here, in his view, is that even though there's this headline-grabbing $7 billion number that the federal government is putting up now, that will actually be dwarfed by the tax breaks that may be available to the industry going forward. And in fact, one an analysis is that this might cost the federal government hundreds of billions of dollars going forward, which of course is going to be a huge expense. And the question is whether this is going to be justified in terms of the environmental benefits that it may have.
Yeah, what is the return on that actual investment? What is the actual investment and what is the return on it? John, right now Mach 2 is doing community engagement to build support. You went to the one virtual session. What's next in this process? What is the kind of timeline for this project now to kind of, I guess, basically build the momentum it needs to get off the ground?
Well, Omar is telling me that he's hoping that the first construction is going to begin in the early 2025. And that the whole thing is going to be up and running later in the decade. This is obviously a huge enterprise, and so I guess those goals are necessarily a bit woolly at this stage. But that's the big picture. And the other thing to bear in mind in terms of the public consultation here is that the DOE actually added a listening session, which will take place online on May 15th. And this is because there were apparently way too many people who wanted to comment at the April 10th session. And so the DOE wanted to give folks another chance to have their say.
Thanks to contributor John Hurdle for his time this week. John's piece on the pros and cons of the proposed Mid-Atlantic Clean Hydrogen Hub plan is available at DelawarePublic.org. And stay with us. We examine the growing trend of taking a gap year before college. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. And I'm Tom Byrne. While many high school graduates spend time this summer preparing to go to college, others will take a so-called gap year with plans to take off on some sort of sabbatical. Postponing the start of college for a year is becoming more common in the United States. According to a survey from the nonprofit College Savings Foundation, more than 22% of students now consider gap time before post-secondary education. In Delaware native Belin Tate's case, they decided to take a gap year recently, where they backpacked out west and earned a Wilderness First Responder certification, among other things. This week, Delaware Public Media's Kyle McKinnon sat down with Tate, currently a freshman conservation biology major at Middlebury College in Vermont, and Ray Nelson, president of the Gap Year Association, a nonprofit gap time advocacy group, to discuss gap years.
Ray, gap years aren't a new phenomenon by any means, but we're talking about them today because they're getting even more popular, and it seems like the concept is being seen in a more positive way. As more students successfully take gap time, how long has this idea of a gap year been around? And when we say gap year, that's literal, right? As in, we do indeed mean 1 year and only 1 year?
Two parts to those excellent questions, Kyle. So first of all, the concept of taking some time off from a traditional pathway to find out about yourself and the world goes back thousands of years. Indians and Aborigines, we take a walk away. We have missionaries. We have students in Europe for a long time who've taken time off from the traditional path. So the concept goes back a long, long time. In America, in the 1980s or so, it started becoming an option for a number of students. And then even more recently, I would say in the 90s, Harvard has been recommending it as an option in their admissions letter, for example, for more than 40 years. A number of universities increasingly are looking at gap year options. And that during COVID in particular, a number of students started looking for them. The second part of your question, a gap year is not necessarily a year. It could be a segment of time. It could be a few months. It could be time during college. Traditionally, we think of it, Kyle, as time after high school and before college. But really, anytime somebody wants to take a break off the beaten path to discover about themselves and the world, and it's intentional, that's gap time. And it almost always is extremely valuable.
Well, you touched on this a bit in your answer there, but what are some of the reasons, though, or some common reasons as to why students take a gap year?
Well, Kyle, it could be a couple of reasons. One is they might be burned out after years of living up to other people's expectations, trying to get the grades, putting in time to extracurricular activities, working if they have to during summers and before or after school, filling out applications. So some of them just really want a break before spending more time in a classroom. For others, the motivation might be they really don't feel that they're ready for college or to go straight to the workplace. After all, we're talking about a pretty significant investment, regardless of whether you go to a public school or private school, you know, all the excellent schools in Delaware, but we're talking about investment. So a student might not feel ready and they may want to find out more about what they want to study, what they want to pursue. A director of admissions at Princeton once said that a definition of insanity is taking a 17 or 18 year old after high school and 3 months later, having him decide what he wants to do for the rest of their lives. So being burned out, wanting to find out more about the world, and taking a break. Those tend to be the two primary motivations.
When we're looking at the short-term and long-term benefits here, how do those distill out when you're taking a gap year? Can you walk us through some of those bigger pros of taking that gap year?
Sure. There's a lot of research out there. And my youngest son took a gap year. So I can testify as a gap year parent, the transformational experience it had. So one of the predominant areas is that personal growth, maturity, confidence, resilience, wanting to embrace education because you understand the real world connection between what goes on in a classroom and goes on in the real world, but particularly that maturity and confidence. A second area, Kyle, would be in what some call employability skills, soft skills. And that would be resilience, teamwork, communication, collaborating, not sweating the small stuff, being able to find solutions and live through a lot of the challenges that life routinely faces us. And then a third area might be those technical skills. Research shows that students who take some time off to explore, and that could be through interning, volunteering, studying, traveling, they find out what they don't want to do maybe, or more about what they want to do. And they might develop those technical skills related to a particular career and profession. So that personal maturity and personal self-development, those employability and life skills that set you up for success in career, school, and in life, as well as those technical skills are just some of the areas of impact. Just one other thing, Kyle, if a student chooses to go to college afterwards, and the vast, vast majority do, I know parents might be concerned if they take time off, are they going to go back? Research shows that more than 90% do within a year. And those who don't, our son ended up taking 2 years because he started a business during his gap time as a young entrepreneur. But those who do go back tend to have higher grade point averages, and they end up graduating in less time than their peers. And so that can be a significant impact as well.
What then about the drawbacks? The one I've always heard, as you just said, revolves around the fact of it being difficult to go back to school after being away for a whole year and how mentally that's just a big hurdle. What about that, Ray? And what do the overall drawbacks of taking a gap year look like?
I think the key, Kyle, the very important key is that it has to be intentional and that the student has to be bought in. In other words, if it's a parent's idea that they think a student should take time off, or if a student thinks, oh, I'm going to sit on the couch and watch video games, I'm not totally against video games, but there has to be an intention. And ideally, the intention will include a result of going back to school or a particular career. So that's why, for example, we recommend applying to college and deferring before you take a gap year. And then while you're on that gap year, really having an intention to explore what you want to do. And what happens, we find, Kyle, is that gappers tend to get very energized about the idea of education. They start wanting to learn. They start recognizing the value of it. And personal research my husband and I did, we found, as I mentioned, more than 90% of students we studied and interviewed not only wanted to go back, went back with intention. But I think that key is making it an intentional gap year with a goal at the end of either college or career, or what specific it was, and then checkpoints along the way so that you're reflecting on what you're learning along the way. And almost every single time that individual, that gapper, ends up energized, excited, and even more successful in their future career, professional, and personal lives.
We now turn to Belen Tate, a Delaware native and current freshman conservation biology major at Middlebury College in Vermont. Before you started college, you took a gap year and you definitely made the most of it and did a whole lot that I want to dive into in just a bit. But when did you start thinking about taking gap time? You know, what initially got the ball rolling on that idea for you?
I started looking at colleges, and Middlebury, the school I go now to, it has a program where you can start if you apply, and if you get accepted, sometimes they accept you as a Feb, which means you start in February instead of starting in September with like the regular students. So I just kind of like didn't really want to go to school after going to school for 13 years. Immediately after, I just wanted to like take a breather, find out a little bit more about myself and find out more about like the world that I'm living in and what I wanted to do with my life.
Right. Well, I read that you backpacked, you rock climbed, canoed, recorded various bird calls, and you even earned your wilderness first responder certification, which is pretty awesome. Can you tell us more about your gap year and all that it kind of entailed though?
Yeah, for 3 months, I was doing a fall semester in the Rockies with Knowles. So that was 3 weeks backpacking in the Wind River Range in Wyoming, 3 weeks or like 2.5 weeks canoeing in Utah, 2.5 weeks rock climbing in the City of Rocks, Idaho. And then we also got our wilderness first responder to at a Knowles ranch. Yeah, so it was really cool. It was just kind of like every day you are moving to a new location and seeing different things. And you were with the same group of 10 people that were similar to your age. Some of them like weren't going to college at all. Some of them just graduated and weren't really sure what they were doing. Some of them were getting credit for their NOLs. And so it was just really interesting to meet lots of different people and realize that like, there's not any set way of doing anything. And you can kind of just live without having to have pressure on you.
Right. Well, I mean, that's a lot packed into a year. How did you plan all that? You know, what did that process look like?
The planning, Knowles is really good at, I think they did most of my planning for me for that part. I ended up going to South Africa for the month of January. So that was kind of spur of the moment. I was just like, oh my gosh, I'm going to have 2 months after my Knowles. And I didn't want to just be sitting at home. So I kind of just Googled and found an internship on a reserve. And I love animals. I want to work with them in my future, I think. So I didn't really plan it. I just kind of did it. I'm not really sure.
There's a lot of beauty in the way you did it, though. And not just, you know, you don't know what you don't know. And you just went in and you did it. So from your own words, from a gapper's perspective, why do you think students should be encouraged to take or at the very least consider taking a gap year?
I mean, you're in school your whole life since you're 5 years old, even sometimes before. And then all of a sudden you're 18 and graduating high school. And like some people know where they're going to go to college. Some people don't even know if they want to go to college. But I think having a gap year is it's super important just to kind of explore. And I can still, like, I don't have to keep doing college if I really don't want to. I know how to live in the world without being in college, and I know how to, like, travel and meet new people and, like, experience other perspectives.
Thanks to Gap Year Association President Ray Nelson, Belen Tate, a Delawarean who took a gap year, and our Kyle McKinnon for joining us on The Green this week. Up next, we head to the University of Delaware, where physical therapy researchers are developing a smart baby monitor that aims to detect developmental delays earlier. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Early intervention for developmental delays like autism can make a huge difference in health outcomes later in life. But it's difficult to diagnose those delays early during crucial child development years. Michelle Lobo, a University of Delaware associate professor and pediatric physical therapist, is working to change that by creating a new smart baby monitor that helps spot delays earlier in childhood. Delaware Public Media's Joey Irizarry talks with Lobo this week about the smart baby monitor and the importance of detecting developmental delays early.
You're working on this smart baby monitor that could make a big difference in how and when we're able to identify development delays in young children. Can you define developmental delays for us in this context and break down what some of the primary types of developmental delays are?
Sure. So there are developmental delays when somebody is not meeting their milestones on time. And this could be their movement, their thinking, their language milestones. So it could be in any of those areas. It could be related to a medical history problem, like maybe preterm birth or low birth weight, or a diagnosis like Down syndrome. But sometimes kids have developmental delay and they have none of those factors in their history. They were typically born healthy, and then all of a sudden they develop a delay for some reason that we don't know. And one thing that we do know is the number of kids with delays is increasing in the US across time. So there are a number of risk factors for it, but it's very hard to predict who is going to have a delay. So that is the definition of developmental delay. The challenge we have is that it's really difficult to identify, especially in the first couple of years of life, because what we do is we look at when you meet milestones. And you might meet a milestone at 6 months, like walking, and you might meet the walking milestone at 18 months, and that's all typical. So you have to look at these bigger pictures of what kids are doing every day to figure out if they have a delay. It can get very, very tricky.
Why are the number of children with developmental delays, why is that rising?
So we don't exactly know, but there are factors like environmental factors, pollution. During pregnancy, if you're exposed to different types of inflammation due to viruses or illness, environmental factors, genetic factors, there are all kinds of factors. Poverty and your environmental experiences, your everyday experiences are a risk factor, plus brain injury around birth or, you know, other problems that happen around birth, C-section delivery. We have all these risk factors. And so it's not an easy to understand problem. So we do have some efforts, like the March of Dimes is trying to decrease the incidence of preterm birth. But again, we don't know all the reasons why people are having preterm delivery. And that's a big risk factor for developmental delay. But this is a big complicated problem that we don't yet know how to fully understand or fully change. So the numbers just keep increasing.
Well, we know that identifying developmental delays earlier can make a huge difference in health outcomes later in life as well. What kind of difference are we talking about here?
Yeah, so we know that if you give targeted interventions to kids, you can see improvements in their movement, in their problem solving, in their thinking, and in their language outcomes, right? So, and social emotional as well. So all of these domains can be impacted. The first 2 years of life are a really critical time to get to kids because that is when your brain is most amenable to change. We have all these connections. There's all this opportunity for plasticity. So we want to take advantage of that. So that's why this idea of getting in as early as possible is important. So I tell people to think about it. Like if you had a stroke or someone you love has a stroke, would you want to wait 3 months to get treatment? Would you want to wait a year to get treatment? No, because the evidence shows that if we start earlier, you're going to show the most gains in that early part of your rehab, right? So it's the same thing for these kids. It's harder to identify. And, you know, in the case of an adult with a stroke, it's easier to identify what has happened. For our kids, it's harder to figure out if they're going to be delayed. But the earliest possible time point we can do that and give them intervention, the better it is for their future outcomes.
What kind of impact can spotting a given delay have on us down the line?
That's an interesting question because I think about it. If you train for a marathon this year and then you don't run for 10 years, you're not going to be able to pick up and run a marathon. So this is a part of a cascading process, right? So it's this idea of starting the intervention early, right? We can start interventions and we see immediate effects. We often don't see if you wait till years later, you know, that those effects stay if you haven't continued to give children supports. So that is an important part of the process, you know, starting early and continuing. There are sort of these follow-up studies, for example, to early Head Start. They show really nice benefits early on, but then at college age, you might not see differences in college enrollment or earnings for kids if they were in early Head Start. But that's kind of an unfair comparison to look at an intervention that's provided before age 5 and then expect if you put children back into situations where they don't have the same level of support that over a decade later, you might still see that they're doing great, right? So it's this idea of if these children have socioeconomic risk factors or medical risk factors, we might continually need to give them supports to see outcomes. But when we start early, we do see really nice benefits. And those benefits can last up to a year or a few years later. There are some studies even for things like skin-to-skin contact in the NICU can lead to benefits 10 years later. If you look 20 years later, I'm not sure you would see it. So it's this idea of starting early and then starting strong, right?
Let's take a closer look at the smart baby monitor you're creating with the NIH Small Business Innovation Research Grant. Walk us through the ins and outs of the monitor. How does it exactly work and what stage of the creation process is it in?
Yeah, so we have a very user-centered design model. That means that we don't want to just make something and then put it out there for people. We want to make sure that we're talking to everyone that would be a part of using it and designing it the way that they would actually like it to be. So we're in the stages now where we have the idea for the product. We know what we might like it to do, but we are working with ChristianaCare to talk to families of kids who might be at risk for delays. We are talking to pediatricians and other primary care providers because we want to figure out how we can make this so that it's easy for parents to use. It's something acceptable to them because you're talking about video and, you know, compiling information from video, securely sharing it with their doctors. How can we make them most secure in that process and make it easy for them to use at home? And then how can we put together the information for the pediatricians in a way that is easy for them in their busy schedules to get out what they would like to get out from it? So that is the stage that we're at right now. We're also working with Shishir Shah, who is at the University of Houston. And he is helping us. He's the chair of computer science, and he's working with video to see, can we pick out accurately some of the things that we'd like to pick out? Because you think, what would I look at for a child to figure out if they're delayed? So, for instance, in the area of physical delay, very early on, there are some indicators that parents and others might not know about, right? Like opening and closing your hands, having that control, being able to move your head against gravity so that when you're on your back, you can look straight ahead, being able to lift your body up against gravity. These are some very, very early abilities that if they are not present and kids aren't doing them consistently, or things like moving both sides of the body, if we're not seeing those things, that can be a very early marker of concern, right? And then the same thing with language a little bit later in development. If we're not hearing babies coo, we're not hearing babies babble, then this computer vision could look at the video and say, oh, this is how often I'm seeing these things, or I'm not seeing these things enough. Provide that information to the doctor, and the doctor can get a good idea about how the baby's doing and if that matches what would be expected for this age.
How did the ball originally get rolling on the idea and creating the monitor?
Yeah, so I was working with folks at ChristianaCare, and they had a collaborator, Tony Ma and Katie Chang at Benten Technologies, and I needed someone to create a platform for an educational program. So we got to know each other that way in talking about having a platform, and then we were thinking about other ways that we could address this problem of under-identification. So, you know, most kids are monitored through their well visits, and that's how we find out if you have a developmental delay. And for doctors, that's a big challenge, because at this well visit, they have to make sure you're staying alive and healthy, check all your systems, give you your vaccines, give parents education. A lot has to happen in there, right? And on top of all that, they have to figure out in a span of just the few minutes that are left over if a child is on target developmentally. That is an unrealistic expectation to place on anybody. When we look at development, you have to see kids across different contexts and longer periods of time to really get an understanding of how they're doing. So what ends up happening is most pediatricians and primary care providers are not wanting to overburden families, not wanting to overstress families, not wanting to overburden the system. So rather than over-identifying people, there's often this idea, well, let's just wait and see. What that results in is that in the first couple of years of life, we're significantly under-identifying kids that need early intervention. So the data suggests that about 90% of the families that would benefit from early intervention for developmental delays are not in the system receiving it. So then we were brainstorming, how else could we approach this problem besides educating parents about providing better experiences for their kids every day? Another way might be to support the primary care providers by providing them with some more information about development, so they're not having just a very limited amount of information to make such an important decision, but they can have more information about what kids are actually doing every day in their natural environment, and using that information to then make a better, earlier informed decision about referrals for early intervention.
Thanks to UD Associate Professor and Pediatric Physical Therapist Michelle Lobo, and our Joe Irizarry for joining us on The Green this week. And we wrap up The Green next with a visit to Old Town Hall in Wilmington to check out the Harriet Tubman Underground Railroad Byway Exhibition. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. A photographic exhibit of the Harriet Tubman Underground Railroad Byway is now on display at Old Town Hall in Wilmington. The exhibition showcases the work of award-winning Delaware-based photographer Lynn Delaplane and is on view until the end of this month. For this edition of History Matters, Delaware Public Media's Kyle McKinnon visited Old Town Hall and met up with Delaplane, Wilmington's historic preservation planner Deborah Martin, and Delaware Historical Society Chief Curator Lee Reifenberg to walk through the exhibition and learn more about the Harriet Tubman Underground Railroad Byway.
Lee, this first question is a two-parter, but this exhibit has been up since March and it's been extended now, or has already been extended till the end of this month. In terms of timeline, why exhibit this now? And can you paint us a picture of the kind of planning that went into this?
We really wanted to make sure that the exhibit was up during Harriet Tubman's birthday, so it was important to have it for the whole month of March. In terms of planning, this is the kind of thing that ideally takes at least 6 months in advance. For a variety of reasons, we didn't have that this time, but that was okay. We had a wonderful group to work with. Lynn and Debbie were both so flexible and fantastic. And our staff is really good at sort of pulling rabbits out of hats when we have to. So we were able to luckily get everything together in the time that we needed.
Well, then, you know, I'm curious. Lynn has been a photographer for decades. What was it like to curate her work specifically?
Really, we played more of a role, sort of a supportive role for Lynn in this situation, because the photographs speak for themselves. Yeah. So we really wanted to mimic the sort of feel of the byway in the space, which I think we were able to accomplish. But it was really a case of just giving Lynn's photography, which, you know, was mounted and ready to go, a space to shine. And fortunately, Council Chambers in Old Town Hall is the best space to do that.
Lee, thank you so much. I appreciate it. All right, Debbie, let's unpack the Harriet Tubman Underground Railroad byway. Not the exhibit necessarily itself, but the actual byway. The lay person, I think, or at least some people out there might be unfamiliar. So can you walk us through what and where the Harriet Tubman byway exactly is, at least here in Delaware on this, coastal, plain, and its, significance in the context of the conversation we're having today?
Sure, I can start with the what. So the byway is a program of the Delaware Department of Transportation and their byways office. For us, it is one way to tell the Underground Railroad story. There are a number of byways in Delaware. This is one of them. We also happen to have parts of the Tubman Byway that run with other byways. So the Bayshore Byway to the south and the Brandywine Valley National Scenic Byway to the north. And that is a tremendous advantage to us to be connected that way. We're almost like that middle bridge between two really great byways. The way that it's laid out, it's 98 miles from Sandtown and Kent County, and it runs to the Pennsylvania line north of Wilmington. The whole idea of how it is laid out is based on what Harriet Tubman had to say about the people and the places that were important to her in Delaware. In between those places that Harriet Tubman specifically mentioned are other stories of freedom seekers, of places of enslavement, of important legal decisions, places that are considered safe houses, abolitionist areas, Quaker meetings. So that sort of fills in. So it's not entirely a Tubman story, but it's arranged according to what she said. It's not necessarily a walk in the footsteps of every place, although there were a couple of places where I would say you can do that. But it's a logical way to move through the landscape while learning about this history.
I think based off of that answer alone, we can understand why this history is so important to, showcase and shine a light on. But, in your view, why is understanding this history and showcasing this exhibit so important, especially in a time like this? What's the impact here? What do you think that kind of significance and impact?
Yeah. That's a pretty broad conversation we could have. I think that this history has been undertold as long as it has existed. But now it's being actively denied. So that's something that makes me nuts. And I've always been drawn to undertold history. So I think it's very important to do it now, especially when there's popular cultural support for it. Since the Harriet movie and the anniversaries, the significant Tubman anniversaries we've been through, but to just hold up the heroes that nobody knows about, besides Tubman, is a mission that we have, because it's not, in the 19th century when people were writing about it, they were covering all of the good white people, mostly Quakers, who were helping, and it seemed very one-sided. But there's huge history about the people who lived in free black communities, who were working every day of their lives to help people who were enslaved, who were passing through, people who had self-emancipated. They were great planners and executors and had so much more to lose than any of the white folks who were helping. And I want to lift them up and help people to understand what this proud history means and how much involvement there was in Delaware.
Delaware has such a rich history. Debbie Martin, thank you so much. I appreciate this.
Thank you.
Lynn, you've been a photographer for decades, but now you have this exhibit. Where did this, you know, the idea for this exhibit specifically come about?
Well, this came about with Debbie, okay. Who is my friend, and we both live in Delaware City. And she called up one day and she said, hey. And then when Debbie says, hey, it's like, uh-oh, here it comes. Because I will do anything for her. It's just, hey, I need a couple photos of coming up Route 9, south of the Reedy Point Bridge, where the marshes are. And it's absolutely gorgeous there. She said, you probably have something like that already that you've, because I've probably taken 10 million photos of everything my whole life. And I said, yeah, probably, but it'll be quicker just to go out with a camera and get a few shots. And this was the beginning of COVID, so I really didn't have that much to do. And I took these photos of the landscape south of Reedy Point Bridge and sent them on to Debbie, and that was that. And then a little bit further on, towards the end of the pandemic, I got another one of those, hey, I have this list. And would you like to photograph these places on the Harriet Tubman Byway and for the Underground Railroad Coalition? And I said, well, I said, it sounds like a lot of fun. My husband, who's sitting over here, Tim, I mean, we just said, yeah, let's do it. We can drive. And I said, but I'm going to need some kind of a map, you know, other than just the one that was on the brochure. So Debbie sent me this wonderful list of all these places starting in Sandtown. And Tim and I, we both love anything history. We enjoy it. He's a Civil War era buff and writer. And it just kind of fell into a nice plan on getting out of the house. It was pandemic time, so there wasn't really that much to do. So I had my letter from the Underground Railroad Coalition that would protect me if anyone caught me with my camera snooping around, because people don't like photographers snooping around properties. And we started with Sandtown and started with the list and just checked off every city. But what really drove it home to me was finding these places like Sandtown. Now, there was nothing there when she came through. You know, these buildings we're looking at now, some of them were original, but they've been built up. So this was wilderness. I mean, not that Delaware's wilderness, but, you know, it was walking through unknown territory for her and finding these little black settlement communities that helped her along the way that really I found really, really interesting. So it took about 8 months of all photographing this, because, you know, you could only do so many a day.
When it comes to the photos you took, how did those get distilled down and discerned for the exhibit then? You know, I imagine you obviously had more than enough to choose from. So how did that...
I took 3,000 photos. We have a saying in the wildlife photography world. It's called spray and pray. You just you just put that camera, take as many photos as you can with one push of the button, and edit for hours and find that one perfect eagle shot where everything's in focus. And that's kind of like how I look at things. I'll just take a lot of photos. Right now, since it's a digital world and we can do that, we don't have to worry about only 12 photos on a roll and make each one of them count. But I still look at my work as if I'm shooting with a 12-photo roll of film and make each one of them count. But I had 3,000 of them by the time I was done with the project. We started in June, and it finished New Year's Day the following year. And then, of course, there's been some added along the way. It's, once again, it's the, hey, you know, I found this place up in Hokesson. Can we add that? It's like, yes, we can add anything.
Thanks to photographer Lynn Delaplane. Wilmington Historic Preservation Planner Deborah Martin, Delaware Historical Society Chief Curator Lee Reifenberg, and our Kyle McKinnon for showing us why history matters this week. And we've reached the finish line for this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter there by clicking Newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page or by emailing us at thegreen@delawarepublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible, contributor John Hurdle, Delaware Public Media's Joe Irizarry, and our senior producer, Kyle McKinnon. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into A First State of Mind.